This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Why is fracking a long-term threat? Why is underground water so polluted? Is rainwater safe to drink anymore? All of this and more as we meet a remarkable mind in Dr. Yuri Gorby. He's an expert in geomicrobiology, the organisms that live underground, often deep underground. He's the Howard N. Blitman Professor of Engineering at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York. Dr. Gorby has studied ways of using bacteria to remediate contaminated water as a possible source of alternative energy, and the way microbes can cause corrosion. And all of that comes to bear in the important issues Yuri Gorby raises. He surprised me. He may challenge your confidence in the environment around us. Yuri Gorby, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you, Alex. Thank you for having me on.
Dr. Gorby, before we begin this wide-ranging discussion, please tell us about your background, because that does matter.
Well, I don't know how far we want to go back, but I do want to say that at a young age, I developed an appreciation for just the natural history or the natural world around me. In growing up in the northern panhandle of West Virginia, living right on a creek, I had access to an ecosystem that I found fascinating and dynamic. And so at a young age, I was really drawn to that type of observational science. And I was also lucky to have a small institute, a college, Bethany College, in my hometown of Bethany, West Virginia, where I actually attended college and learned a little bit more about the science of the biology around me. After that, I went on and I just was now fascinated with science and especially microbiology. And I went and I conducted a PhD at the University of New Hampshire, where I studied another fascinating group of organisms, magnetotactic bacteria. These things are just fascinating, and they have an interaction with the larger world around us in their direct interactions with the electromagnetic fields that the Earth actually emits. That's another area of study that we could go on for hours. But what I really became interested in was the interaction of microorganisms and especially important metals. So I became fascinated by a group of organisms that were recently discovered, organisms that could breathe iron and manganese as we breathe oxygen. And then after that, my interest came to work on a discovery that some organisms could really breathe some really crazy metals like uranium and plutonium and technetium. And we went on to study those for about 15 years at the Hanford Nuclear Reservation in Richland, Washington. And there I really became kind of involved in government-led research on problems of significance that were related to our environment. Environmental and human health implications were quite the motivating factor. There also, I found that there was, you know, to conduct that type of research, there was quite, you know, you had to have a good team of people and were disciplined, and you had to have the funding to be able to do that. And so that background really educated me about how sound, solid science really functions. And so I really enjoyed a great group of people there. And then I continued my work, though, in interest of these microorganisms, and worked for 5 years with the J. Craig Venter Institute down in San Diego, where I got a little bit more familiar about the guys that are the molecular miracle makers around us, the guys that do gene sequencing and analysis. And I could really understand or get firsthand observation of that group of scientists. But I never really caught on to that very well. I'm more of a physiologist, like how do natural microorganisms work? And how do we better understand their activities that have been on this planet for nearly 3.5 billion years? So that's my background, my science background. And I think that my interest in this topic at hand, hydraulic fracturing, really came from my interest of these microorganisms that we were working with in the deep subsurface, organisms that might impact the migration of things like uranium and technetium in contaminated groundwaters. And I saw that there was something happening back in my home state of West Virginia that I just thought that I could actually help contribute to. So I moved back east and I took this job with Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, and really glad to be among those great engineers and scientists up there. My intention was to be able to study some of this, what's going on in the shale fields down there in terms of the obvious to me at that time, even early on, about, you know, when I was just made aware of it only about 3 years ago, that there was something traumatic happening in the subsurface, that the insults that we see to those deep formations and the amount of fluids that are used and the types of chemicals that we are suspected are being used and now know are being coming back up out of those formations. For me, that was just unbelievable that it was happening in these very sensitive ecosystems where I grew up. I mean, I worked out in the middle of a desert or a semi-arid area of the Hanford Nuclear Reservation for those 15 years. And there was problems out there with nuclear materials and uranium and moving in the groundwater, but nothing of the magnitude that I saw happening around West Virginia. And I have to say, over the last few years, the magnitude of that problem has increased, and the serious ecological and human health impacts are being, you know, are manifesting in front of our eyes. And I'm just, I'm almost kind of felt, yeah, unable to respond right now because of how quickly it's happening and really what needs to be done. And that is for groups of scientists to focus their attention, not just on the issues of hydraulic fracturing, but the larger, the greater issue that I've seen now in the shale fields. And that is that of the quality of water. That's something that we will not be able to recover from very easily, if it ever, in those fields. Even if we stop right now, the threat to water is obvious, but we can go on about that.
Right. West Virginia, you know, it's amazing that people would blow the tops off of mountains to get at coal. But here in West Virginia and all over the United States, people are blowing up the underground. And we have the idea that these are just, well, it's just rocks down there and it's lifeless. But you know better than that. There is a lot of life down there, isn't there?
Indeed. I mean, we have programs. I'm part of a NASA Astrobiology Institute effort to see how life can live in really low energy environments deep within the earth. There are deep ocean drilling programs that are solely dedicated to answer the question, how deeply can microbial life live on this planet? And you know, what does it mean to have those life forms down there? Now, the shale formations that we're currently drilling into in West Virginia and Pennsylvania and Ohio are 350 million-year-old formations. We may think that they're devoid of life, but in fact, they're teeming with life. And there are some efforts now to characterize that life. But some of that life can actually do some pretty kind of damaging things to overlying strata if they are brought up from those depths in large volumes, one of them being the sulfate-reducing bacteria generating hydrogen sulfide and tremendous amounts of hydrogen sulfide forever from these deep formations that are now communicating with the overlying strata. Those are like putting little sulfur burners in our water supplies and generating ultimately, if and when that hydrogen sulfide reaches those water resources, will generate hydrogen sulfide and then sulfuric acid as it starts to be oxidized and transformed by bacteria. These are things that we have to take seriously because, well, I don't think that those that are driven by removing or extracting the wealth from those materials are driven by, are motivated more by their ability to do so and the profits and the economic growth that it will yield, but they are not considering the long-term implications, well, the short and long-term implications of the impact of stimulating those microbial populations and then allowing those microbial populations to be stimulated forever.
I don't want to go over the top on this, but I talked with Dr. Peter Ward, and he's a paleoclimatologist out in Washington State. And his theory, which has been, Princeton published his book about it, was that these sulfur-producing bacteria actually started to flourish in a more acidic ocean in a previous global warming period and were, in fact, responsible for wiping out about 90% of the land species. So, yeah, there's a bit of a backstory there about what can happen when you get a different kind of bacteria going in our system, and we don't want to do that. But just last week, you attended a Department of Energy meeting on the ways contamination spreads in subsurface systems. What did you hear about, and what did you not hear about that these experts failed to discuss?
Well, these experts are, in fact, my friends and colleagues and program managers that have developed and maintained productive science-based programs that investigated the complexity of subsurface systems. That's what we were involved in. The name of the program is the Subsurface Biogeochemical Research Program. This program had been going on and different iterations of it for a couple of decades now. And that community then, we were very, functional and collaborative. What I failed to see here for the third year in a row is the availability of funding for that group of scientists to actually conduct credible research on the impact of hydraulic fracturing and related activities to groundwater resources, flow dynamics, contaminant transport, everything that they've done. They do not have access because of the way funding structures in that program have transpired. Now, that could be hours and hours of discussion what's going on there. But from my position right now, in my opinion, what's really missing is funding for those very group of scientists that I met with this week, because they don't have that type of fund to conduct this research. They are being driven in other directions, driven into climate models, and it's too detailed to go into right now.
Okay. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Dr. Yuri Gorby. We're talking about what lurks underground and in the sky around you. Let's get specific, Yuri. It turns out you've studied the way underground pipes can corrode. What is happening and what will happen to the pipes that are supposed to contain fracking chemicals?
Yeah, corrosion is something that I've gotten into quite recently. Some of our recent discoveries on microorganisms that can actually move electrons by little filaments that we call bacterial nanowires have the potential to accelerate corrosion by setting up these little battery cells in these systems called microbially influenced corrosion. What I see with the piping and the pipeline network that's being rapidly developed around and in the shale fields, and then the transmission line that leads away from those shale fields to the processing and distribution and export sites, mostly along the coast, that there are different types of materials that are being moved. There are different qualities of pipe that are being used. There are different inspection schedules for each of the grades of pipes. And there are different rules about how you can defend yourself against a pipeline going across your land. What we see in the areas that are developing with well pads, where you have active well development, you have lines that are collector lines that are relatively small lines that are running up and down over the hillsides, especially where you get in hilly regions. You'll see these kind of clear-cut areas, and then a backhoe will dig a large ditch, and they'll lay these pipes down in there, and they will collect and then pull the product away from the raw product away from these well pads. Those are really meant for temporary use, and they're not subjected to inspections. So these will tend to fail. They've been constructed. The engineering of the hillsides is not stabilized in many cases, and we see instance upon instance of erosion and failure of these pipelines that are hastily put together with inferior materials. And so the people that are living near those pipelines, where they go across your land or you allow a right-of-way, are really living in a needless danger. I mean, I think that it could be done properly, but again, because of the lack of oversight on the integrity of that, of those pipelines, they are not really the safest thing to be around. The larger transmission lines, 30-inch, 32-inch, larger ones, interstate lines that are taking product away, those are subjected to more rigorous inspection. However, they are carrying product that still can contain abrasive materials, like small flecks of silica sand that can still scar the pipeline. There is condensate or still vapors that can be things that can condense in the lines, that can pool up in the lines. You can still have corrosion. We're going to see the failures of those as the network grows and increases. We will have continued failure, as we've seen in many places around the country and in Canada. Yeah, pipeline failure is something that is a reality and will only increase as the infrastructure increases.
It's happening all over the place. I just see the news stories practically every day, not quite, but close to it. You know, Dr. Gorby, fracking is the wonder child of the energy industries these days. It's the miracle recovery tool promised by many national governments. And One of the early people to question fracking was Dr. Robert Howarth of Cornell University. I've interviewed him. He came under intense pressure, including criticism from other faculty there. Then the EPA study showed he was absolutely correct about methane leaking out of the natural gas system. Do you worry that the emphasis you're putting on the dangers of fracking will bring pressure on you personally?
Well, I hope that it doesn't. I mean, that type of response, we have seen it happen from many different credible people trying to bring some of their knowledge to the table to discuss these. These are not accusatory terms. These are just that we have to have frank discussion and open information exchange to be able to fully assess this, to fully evaluate risk versus benefit if we want to do that. But in the absence of that information about not just what chemicals are used or, you know, what toxicity levels they have, but the low dose, this is something that I've now become fully aware from my ecology friends, that you have these nonlinear low dose responses to mixtures of different chemicals. There is complexity in those unknowns. That even if we had every information about the chemicals that are being used and their allowable limits, that when they're released into our environment, that the ecological impacts can be devastating, even at low concentrations, and the long-term health implications for human populations, especially the most sensitive among us, pregnant women, children, the elderly, immunocompromised, without considering that portion of our population, we are taking risks, or we are calculating risks that we have no right to calculate. And so I hope that, you know, those that seek to discredit people like Bob and now Tony Ingraffia and others would see what is really motivating them and the potential implications of their actions to our, you know, fellow Americans and our fellow human beings.
You know, I forgot to ask you about the fate of radioactive materials brought up out of the earth by fracking. You mentioned that. What is the situation there?
Well, these ancient seabeds that have yielded these shale deposits are accumulators in many instances of things like uranium. So uranium reduction was something that I really like to study, and the uranium that has been precipitated or accumulated in these ancient seabeds is related to the microorganisms and the activities that I study. So I really am interested in this. But when you extract those drill cuttings, I mean the material, so you know each well bore can, you know, you can have a horizontal run that can be a half mile or up to a mile. And that can be a 7 7/8 inch bit that's moving around a little bit, so you can have a huge volume of material that's brought back up to the surface. And that material currently is being sent largely to landfills where it's being tilled into the soil, heap leached with spent frack fluids, and then basically buried in place. Now, there are some concerns about that. First of all, the leachate that comes out from that activity is now enriched or contains materials, radioactive materials that are naturally occurring radioactive materials. That's a term or a set of terms that's used to describe the uranium and radium that is, and other isotopes that are naturally present in this material. But it is still radioactive material nonetheless. And these naturally occurring radioactive materials, or NORMs, are now being modified or technologically enhanced, and they do enter this new classification of T-NORMs, technologically enhanced NORMs. And so these materials and their deposition in these big landfills and the leaching of the material through that, so the percolation of that tilled-in material, leads to the formation of this liquid leachate form that is now being implicated as it goes through a water treatment process or is being released into the environment for the increasing levels of radiation that are detected in sediments at outfalls near these facilities. And there are some good publications on that, especially from the group from Duke University.
Let's get to another topic that we've discussed briefly, which is how pollution can travel in the air. People just aren't aware, I think, of the particulates that are floating all around the Northern Hemisphere from China, from the United States, from Europe, and affecting our health. The United Nations just came out with a big study saying that that kind of airborne pollution is responsible for millions of deaths every year. It's a big deal. So what do you have to say about that?
Yeah, you know, I grew up in the Ohio Valley. I mean, I was born in Steubenville, Ohio, and I think for 2 of the 3 years or of the 5 years that I lived there in my short life, Steubenville was rated the filthiest air quality in the nation. You know, so a dubious distinction there.
Steel plants.
Yeah, it was the coke plants. They have the steel plants where my father worked. You know, we lived down very close to them, and I think that that's one of the reasons why my father moved us out of that town out into the countryside in West Virginia, was to, you know, improve the air quality around us. But, you know, most of us are familiar with acid rain. We know what generated it. We know the regional political issues that were involved and the regional economic issues that were involved. We know the reactions that occurred to lead to the formation of sulfuric acid from burning of high sulfur coal in Ohio and West Virginia and drifting up into New England. But when I started asking around lately about, has anyone heard about chemical rain? You know, no one really knew what I was talking about. And I didn't actually know what I was talking about either, because, you know, I'm just thinking, well, if you have particles or you can release chemistry into the atmosphere that leads to the production of sulfuric acid, then if you release other chemicals and particulates into the atmosphere, then that rain or the condensation that forms in that and it then rains down on the ground will also be modified by those chemicals and particulates. And so I became interested in this and actually gained some insights from Dr. David Brown from the Southwestern Pennsylvania Environmental Health Project and the folks there who have described the role of weather on air quality. And that was really interesting to me. And it's just, you know, people can look at the site. I think it's, you go to Southwestern Environmental Health Project and then just search for how's the weather. And you'll see a short kind of animated video there describing this very phenomenon that, you know, how you can have particulates come down or be brought back to Earth fully dependent on weather. And so I think that there's, you know, an opportunity here for all of us to, well, I think that you're one of the things that we have to consider now is that in industrialized areas, especially where areas are rapidly being, their environment is being modified, the quality of their groundwater is being compromised because of drilling activity or releases from spills or any other activity in the area, and that people may turn toward rainwater capture as an option. And I will caution people that, you know, to take care, because the quality of that rainwater coming through an atmosphere that has been compromised by chemicals being released by those activities, you could really be concentrating these things and then directly delivering them to your animals, to your plants, to your garden. So we are now just writing up a proposal to fund a small campaign for citizen science where people in industrialized areas and in pristine areas can go and capture some of that rainwater, especially the rain that first falls when the storm begins, and then send that off to us for analysis for the particulates and the chemicals that are contained in there, and also the microbiology, because those particulates in the atmosphere can also distribute microorganisms that may be released from aerosolization of these wells or glycol dehydrators or any process that's associated with this and any other activity.
You would think that the government is already checking our rainwater, but I know that they're not. And the political situation is such that they probably don't want to. I talked to Dr. Joel Schwartz of Harvard, who said that there are particulate domes over the cities of the eastern United States that you can see from space, especially during the summer. It's sort of weather dependent and it can be rained out after a few days, but it's there. And then I also talked with people doing studies of women in Harlem, were wearing backpacks, and they measured the air. And what they found was that the particles in the air are almost like little meteors. They have a lot of surfaces, and those surfaces were coated with diesel byproducts, with pesticides, with all sorts of nasty things that shouldn't be there. So I'm wondering, you know, where I lived, when I lived in the city, there was a lot of traffic near me. There was rail traffic. I had two HEPA air filters going all the time. Do you think I was just being paranoid, or was I being smart?
No, I think that you were being quite smart. That the particulates that we inhale, they can have resonance times in our lungs that are extended, and as you rightly pointed out, they can be coated with all kinds of everything, all kind, you know, the materials, even volatile organic compounds can absorb or partition to those surfaces and be delivered to your lungs. Again, Dr. Brown discusses this and the importance of just a simple filtration of the air can have a big effect on air quality and human health by removing those particles that are delivering those hazardous materials to your lung tissue, to your sensitive tissues. And so, yeah, there are large capacity air scrubbers that you can put into homes. This is one of the shelter in place approaches that the Southwestern Pennsylvania Environmental Health Project and now myself and all others are recommended for people that are living in these areas to take shelter in place, seal yourself off as much as possible from the outside environment, and then scrub those particles out of the air using a high-capacity air scrubber. Now, these things are not inexpensive. They can be $500 or more, but they do improve quality of air and health of the people that are in those places. The other thing is that even a simple mask, a 0.03 micron filter mask, can have a big effect on people that are outside walking around, and I highly recommend it for anyone that's walking around in the shale gas fields because of the particulate silica sand that's now omnipresent and floating around, also coated with hazardous materials.
Yeah, and, you know, we see people in China wearing these masks, and we think how strange that is, but a lot of us should be thinking about that, too. You also, Yuri Gorby, also look for answers. What about using microbes to help us detoxify the mess we're making?
Yeah, for about 15 years, I worked for the U.S. Department of Energy and justified my research on these uranium-reducing bacteria to do that type of thing. But the fact is that once an environment is contaminated, it is very difficult to clean it up. I don't think that we can consider ourselves successful in cleaning up the using microorganisms to clean up the uranium and chromium problems that we created during the Cold War. I mean, it would have been much better to deal with those waste streams as they were generated and not release them into the environment. Unfortunately, you know, we did not have that foresight, but we can now because, you know, there are scientists like myself that are saying openly, the best way to clean a place up is to never make it dirty in the first place. And so we have the opportunity to slow down or stop the continued contamination of our precious freshwater resources and the air that we're breathing in these areas. We could stop that now and deal with the environmental problems that have already been created by the activity thus far. That's what I recommend that we do. I know that it will be a shock to the economic system, but because of the prospecting and the hope that has been laid on this miracle technology for raising our economic status once again. However, it can't come at the cost of our precious water resources because we cannot drink that material that we are releasing into the environment, and it's contaminating all of the water in the region where I grew up. I never recommend anyone drink the groundwater in areas that I once thought were safe. I just can't without knowledge of what's going on in there and what has been released in those areas. It's a risk we just simply can't take.
Well, as we wrap up, is there anything that I've missed that you would like to pass on to our listeners?
Well, I think that something that I try to remember or I approach systems is that we are all connected. I mean, we live in a little reactor, like a little ball floating around in space. And I try to relate this to my students now, too, that, you know, if we can just see that what has come behind us, before us, has led to what we are now, and what we are doing to this planet will lead to have an effect. It is having an effect. Then students can start to understand that, you know, the time frame that we're talking about is much greater than just this short 200 or 300 years of industrialization, where the need for growth and our economic structure is based on the consumption of a resource that took millions, hundreds of millions of years to accumulate and to be sequestered into the earth, that the rapid and extreme extraction of that and transformation into the atmosphere is suicidal. It is the same as working on your car in a garage with the door closed. You know, there is only a certain amount of resistance of an ecology to changes, and we are exceeding that. So the hope that I see is that we do have young people now, and I get this from the students that I teach and my colleagues who also get this kind of, that are empowered by working with these young people, that they see that there are issues of immediate concern, and they are quite capable and willing to put their abilities toward addressing those problems, and we need to provide them the opportunity to do that. But if we're continuing to contaminate the environment and the water and make the problem worse, then they will have no chance at saving this. So that's my bottom line.
All right. And Dr. Gerby has asked me to mention that our discussion today is really about his own opinions and experience in life and not that of the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York, where he is a professor. So like all of us, he has almost a dual life. He's an expert who pursues scientific research, but he's also a private citizen who comes across some threats that we all need to know about. So I want to thank you very much for talking with us on Radio EcoShock.
Well, it's been a pleasure, and I look forward to talking with you again, Alex.
And I'll put some links, listeners, to what we've been talking about in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Be sure and check that out. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.